You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 61. I am your somewhat sick host, Thomas Smith. And so because of that, I'm not going to do much preamble here. I'm just going to get to a really excellent interview with Qasim Rashid. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I think we disagree a lot, and I think we're coming from two very unique places. And it's a conversation that I don't think I've ever heard, like the kind of conversation we had, which is why I wanted to do it. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Without any further rambling, let's get over to my interview with Qasim Rashid. Joining me right now is Qasim Rashid, and thank you for the pronunciation help on that, Qasim. Nice to speak to you.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Great to be here.
It is really good to have you. I'm super curious how exactly this will go, because I feel like we're coming from such different perspectives, but I think we share a lot in common. And I know, for example, I mean, you're a big advocate of Black Lives Matter. That's really cool. That's something that's important to me too. You're interested in, well, there's a lot. I'll let you speak for yourself, but I can't wait. Sure. Thanks for having the conversation. But would you mind, for those not familiar, maybe give a brief background, where you're coming from, who you are, that kind of stuff?
Definitely. So Qasim Rashid, you got my name right, rhymes with awesome. I'm a national spokesperson for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community, which is the nation's oldest Muslim organization. We're worldwide in scope, and we are united worldwide under a caliph, which makes people panic when they think of caliph, because they think we're talking about that terrorist in Iraq and Syria. But the caliphate that leads the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is a spiritual caliphate that believes in separation of mosque and state, and universal human rights and stuff that we can get into a little bit later on. Mm-hmm. I'm an author, I'm an attorney, I'm married to my wonderful wife. We have three very awesome children, and I practice law in DC and Virginia.
Oh, that's excellent. Okay. Yeah, my partner Andrew Torres over on Opening Arguments also practices law in DC. So that's what do you know? I guess it's a good place to be.
It is. Well, depending on perspective, but yeah. I mean, for human rights work, it's definitely great to be here in DC, and that's kind of why I chose to move here after growing up in Chicago.
Right. So what would you say has been the focus, I suppose, of your activism? And your book is Talk to Me, by the way. Check it out, everyone. What would you say has been your some of your main goals and what you're trying to accomplish in terms of the, I suppose, the dialogue around Islam and other things?
Well, I think if I had to pick one driving motivation, it would have to be universal freedom of conscience. I think everything stems from that. Black Lives Matter, you know, a gender equality, you know, rights for children, you name it. I think everything comes down to this fundamental concept of universal freedom of conscience. And that when you look at the world, Pew came out with a global attitude survey, I think in 2011, where they reported that roughly 75% of the world, over 5 billion people, live under some form of religious or social oppression, either from the government or through society. And there's a direct correlation and causation as well, that the more oppressive a society becomes in terms of freedom of conscience, the more violent and extremist it also becomes. And on the flip side, the more pluralistic a society becomes in terms of permitting people to believe whatever it is they want to believe without oppression, then the more progressive and peaceful it becomes. People live longer, people live healthier, they live happier. And so my driving focus, that I've taken as inspiration from the Quran, from the example of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is that I should do everything I can to champion universal freedom of conscience. And within that, that also means service to humanity. So that means, you know, feeding the poor and speaking up for those who are being marginalized, or giving my platform to those who are marginalized so they can speak for themselves. But it really drives back to this fundamental principle that people should be allowed to believe or not believe whatever it is that they want, with, as long as they're not hurting somebody else, of course. But that fundamental aspect is missing in our world right now. And I feel like what's happening in the United States is under threat in many respects we can talk about. But that's really why I get up in the morning.
Totally agree with where you're coming from there. I think that's really awesome work that you're doing. And I think where the conversation gets, I suppose, interesting is as someone who's an atheist and you know, secular, I tend to see a bit of a correlation between, I suppose, Islam in the world and this lack of separation of mosque and state, I guess. And I know one thing that's really interesting in the atheism community, and I'm sure that you've seen this. I know you're pretty big on Twitter, so I'm sure you deal with a lot of anti-Muslim bigotry, a lot of I don't know if you prefer or if you like the term Islamophobia. I think from ex-Muslims I've talked to, they prefer anti-Muslim bigotry, but that's another discussion. There is a fine line to walk between criticizing some bad ideas that, you know, from my standpoint, I see a lot of bad ideas in Islam, as I do in Christianity and other religions. But doing that and then being sort of an anti-Muslim, which I of course see as a bad thing. And I see what Trump is doing is awful. I see his solutions and his, you know, the support that he has is really detestable and racist and bigoted in a lot of ways. So that's but it's so interesting because when I see the way you're coming from, because it seems like when you talk about being, is it Ahmadi or Ahmadiyya or both?
Both work, yeah.
Oh, okay. For being Ahmadi, is it fair to say it's a very small group of Muslims?
Well, I mean, how do you define small? I mean, if you want to talk about
the numbers, I guess.
Overall, yeah, I mean, even numbers, right? I mean, if you want to talk about the single largest Muslim community in the world that's united under one leader, it's undoubtedly the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. I mean, we're, like I said, we're in over 200 nations worldwide. We have been around for 130 years. We run about 17,000 mosques, close to 1,000 secular educational institutions, several dozen hospitals, and I don't know how many water wells and villages we're building, smart schools we're building around the world. So from that standpoint, nobody, and I'll fight this tooth and nail to anybody based on facts, there's no single Muslim community that is larger than us on a worldwide scale, none. And there's no community that can provide this proven model of Islam. This is what I talk about as well, that when I'm presenting an argument that Islam teaches X, I'm not just saying this is my scriptural interpretation, because anyone can come up with any interpretation they want, right?
Yeah.
What I'm saying is this is the right model, and here is a proven 130-year example showing that this model works, that it's not just theory. So this terrorist in Iraq and Syria, al-Baghdadi, who's promoting this violent concept of Islam, the reason why we can show that that has no merit is one, it's not provable, it's not sustainable, it's being destroyed and obliterated, right? So if it's truth, it should withstand the test of time. It's gone, 2 years now, 3 years, and it's on the verge of collapse. The second thing is, and I think this part you'll definitely agree with me on, is that if you have truth, you don't need a gun. If you have truth, you don't need to force people to believe it. The only time you need to force people to believe something is when you don't have truth and you have to make up for it in that weakness. That's why you have censorship laws. That's why you have blasphemy laws. That's why you have apostasy laws, when you don't have truth. And you need to force people to believe what you believe, because otherwise, if they think logically and rationally, they realize this is a bunch of garbage and I want nothing to do with it. I mean, I think we agree there, right? I don't know
that in that, like in what context you're speaking of, because I would certainly think that, you know, around the time of World War II, a lot of people needed guns who, you know, I think would probably, roughly speaking, had the truth. I think it kind of depends on the context of what's going on in the world.
Well, we're talking about religion. We're not talking about...
Okay, so if you're talking about spreading your religion or trying to spread your ideas. Right, yeah.
Right. I mean, because you asked me in the context of, you know, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, and I'm telling you from a religious standpoint, this is why I believe that this is the true interpretation of Islam, because we spread with peace, with education, with logic. I mean, if you're talking about World War II, that's a whole different conversation altogether.
Okay, yeah, that's why I want to clarify the context. I think I agree with you in the context you're speaking of. I didn't mean to try to pinch you into the wrong thing. I was just checking.
I think blanket answers in general are a bad thing, but no, sure, I was responding specifically to your question about the Ahmadiyya Muslim community and where I would differentiate us, you know, to like a Wahhabist or a Daesh or a Taliban or any other kind of group. Is we are the ones who are fighting for religious freedom, fighting for the right of people to leave Islam if they want to leave Islam without any kind of oppression or violence. My first book, The Wrong Kind of Muslim, has a whole chapter dedicated to people in Pakistan who are leaving Islam. And I argue that they are making a moral decision, because what they've been shown is a religion of hate, of violence, of terrorism, of oppression and misogyny. Now, we can argue about whether that Islam actually teaches those things or not. I say it does not.
Right.
But the point I make is that what they've been presented as morality is in fact immoral, and they're making the moral decision, the right decision, to leave that life and pursue whatever it is, you know, they feel best pursuing. But whether I agree with their beliefs or not, the one thing that's clear is that they should be allowed to leave Islam without any fear of punishment or harm or retribution or retaliation.
So I want to say first and foremost that I agree with I can't even think of one of your values that you've mentioned that I don't agree with beyond, you know, I'm not religious. I don't believe in anything supernatural, but no big deal. Like, I just want to say your values sound excellent to me. It sounds like the kind of thing I would want to be spreading. And I just want to make that clear. But I wonder if you could comment on, because I'll just talk about Christianity, because that's, you know, that's the community or the, I suppose, the religion that I've dealt with more in my personal life, just based on, you know, where I live and all that. And yeah. It's so interesting as an atheist, because when I see people, let's say a really progressive Christian sect or something, arguing that, no, actually the Bible is totally cool with things like homosexuality and all that. And it's such a weird experience, because it's like, on one hand, I'm like, well, that's a good idea, and I would rather more Christians believe that gay people are people. You know, like, I would rather more Christians have these good beliefs. But at the same time, I see the arguments and I look at the text and I'm like, that doesn't really say that. Like, it's from an atheist perspective, it's like, there's no reason that I would believe someone in the first century or the seventh or eighth century would have had the right ideas about homosexuality. I just don't. They could have, but I don't, there's no reason that I would by default assume that. And when I look at the Bible in context, it just doesn't seem to be true. And you can make different arguments, you can interpret things different ways. But so it that's why it's such an interesting conversation, I think, for you and I to have. What could you comment on that? Like, how do you, do you at least understand, like, from my perspective, when I look at the Ahmadi Muslims, who I take your point that you have the largest, like, organized, you know, sect. But in terms of just numbers, if I'm from an outsider's perspective and I'm looking at the Pew polls and I'm looking at the population, I see that Ahmadis are something like 1% of Muslims. And I don't know if you want to dispute those statistics. That's the numbers I'm seeing. So it's weird, because when you look at the Pew polls, the number of Muslims who believe really horrendous things is far higher than 1%. Right. At least certain things.
So, I mean, I think it's probably closer to 3%, 4%, but at that point, you're still in single digits, right? So your point is still valid, right? Mm-hmm. But I think we need to look at two things. One, percentage and influence are two different things. I mean, the United States is 4% of the world's population, but the world revolves around the United States, or at least it has been until last couple of years. So maybe I'm undercutting my own argument.
I know. Yeah, it's finally not. And it's so funny, because I have so many international listeners, and they do like to call out from time to time, like, hey, you know, there's other countries. It's like, darn it, you're right. Sorry.
I mean, absolutely. But I think you see my point, right? Like, from an economic military powerhouse standpoint, the United States is still on top, right? And so influence and size are two different things. So that correlation doesn't necessarily meet. The numbers I spat out about 70,000 mosques. I mean, I'll give you another one. The whole Muslim world combined has translated the Quran into about 30 languages. Mm-hmm. Our allegedly minority community has translated the Quran into over 75 languages. Hmm. So the influence and the impact is significant, right? We were the first ones to launch an international satellite network, which is still going strong today. Muslim Television Ahmadiyya. You can check it out at mta.tv. But on a deeper level, and I think this is really where the rubber meets the road, that if somebody is coming to me and says, hey, Islam says that apostates should be killed, my first question to them is very simple. Prove it to me. Show me in the Quran where it says this. And what I can tell you, and what I can tell your listeners, is that for 130 years, we've issued, because in our community was founded in 1889, for nearly 130 years, we've issued this challenge that meet us in the field of debate on these questions and on these issues. And every single cleric or mullah or extremist who has claimed such a thing has backed off. And their only rebuttal has been, we're going to censor your books completely. we're going to block access to them completely. Mm-hmm. We will not let people read them. And so if that has been the answer of these extremists, you know, I mean, let's take our White House, for example, right? Our White House, if it is shutting off media access to the press briefings over and over and over again, what are people going to think? Mm-hmm. Are you going to believe a White House that will continue to shut off press briefings? Of course not. Why would you? Who would believe in their right mind somebody who continues to censor information and not allow people to decide for themselves?
Right.
And so, you know, when people make these claims, outlandish, you know, that gays should be killed, for example, I said, okay, fine, go, show me from the Quran where it says that. And if you can't, then stop censoring those who are promoting an idea that you simply can't refute. Yeah, the founder of our community, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, once wrote that any religion that uses the sword to spread cuts its own throat before reaching others. And that's the fact here. You know, these groups like Daesh that are promoting these barbaric ideologies, like throwing gay people off roofs, or like raping women and calling them their sex slaves. The reason why they have to force these things is because they don't have the ability to meet scholars in the field of debate, in the field of logic, in the field of argument, or dispute the centuries of history that prove otherwise. I mean, people forget the 700-year golden age of Islam, where Muslims advanced in unprecedented fields. This wasn't by accident. This was because the Quran.
Well, but it also wasn't Ahmadi by definition, right?
Well, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community started 130 years ago. So,
right, yeah, that's what I mean.
I guess the point I'm trying to make here then is that what we're promoting is not a reformation of Islam. It's a revival of Islam that led to 700 years of growth and progress in academics, in astronomy, in physics, in mathematics, in astronomy, in medicine, in aeronautics, in camera technology. I'm going to keep hitting that point home hard because education is a foundation of any progressive society. It's a foundation of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. It's why we've been successful at what we do. And it's because of education that we had, you know, the first Muslim scientist to win a Nobel Prize was an Ahmadi Muslim. The first Muslim president of the UN General Assembly was an Ahmadi Muslim. One of the first directors of the World Bank was an Ahmadi Muslim. So this is what I mean when I say it's a proven model, that if it didn't work, we wouldn't have these success stories in this century-long history to prove that it actually works.
This is super fascinating. So I think that from what I'm hearing from you and from the little research I've done on this, I think it makes a ton of sense that in terms of, I suppose, worldwide influence or maybe even like Western influence, Ahmadi Muslims seem to, because your ideals, from my perspective, are objectively better than others. Like your ideals of openness, education, secularism, like I believe those ideals are objectively better. And sure. For that reason, I think that's probably why all the things you mentioned, how well your community has done, your specific religion has done. I think that's why, because those are good values and they encourage education, they encourage accomplishment, they're not worried about people believing exactly certain things or not overly concerned with your behaviors in the bedroom, for example. Like they're not bogged down with stuff like that. So that makes sense. But it's a weird question. I think the part that I can't quite wrap my mind around is how you judge what a religion is. Because I think that if I were to try to throw at you, I've done some limited research here. I've got pages and pages of horrendous Quran quotes. But I'm not an expert. Like I think you would probably wipe the floor with me once I said, oh, what about this one? This is your religion. This is something you've studied. You would have the apologetics for it. But it's just hard because when it comes to Christianity, how do I measure what Christianity is short of what the majority or what the most Christians believe? Because when you look at the Bible, now the Bible and the Quran might be fundamentally different. I don't know. But in the Bible is so large and vast that you are just able to pick which parts you want. And if Christians are not doing things like stoning each other, if they're not doing things, even bad things that Jesus said, for example, and by the way, Christians, largely speaking, I'll just speak for in the U.S., Christians are not even like very good, like with charity and with a lot of Jesus's good teachings. Like they don't do those, like all the stuff about rich people really have no chance of getting to heaven and just all this stuff. Like largely speaking in this country, they're not even good at that. So how do I judge like what is Christianity? And the only thing I can do from an atheist, from an outsider perspective, would say, well, it kind of is as it does. Like Christians are as they do, essentially, because it might morph and they might, this particular passage might go out of vogue and then another one might be focused on. And it's sort of equally valid in a way. And so when I turn to Islam, I can't help but kind of look at it the same way. Maybe you could make better arguments than them about the Quran. I'm not sure. But I do know that there are plenty of, I mean, what I couldn't help but call scholars who are on the side of ISIS. Yeah, I'm in the middle of Graham Wood's book on that very thing. I mean, it does exist. You may disagree with it. I may disagree with it, but it does exist. So how, you know, like how do I deal with that? That's the question.
So a couple of things to look at, right? So one, I think it's important to understand that no group is a monolith, right? I mean, if I want to talk about atheists, I'm not going to go and say, well, look at atheist China. You know, it's 1.3 billion atheists there. And they are consistently a country of particular concern for religious oppression. They destroyed 400 crosses last year. Right. They're forcing Muslims to stop fasting, forcing them to shave their beards, forcing women to remove the hijab. It's a pretty abrupt. So therefore, all atheists everywhere are just horrible human beings, right? I mean, nobody in their right mind makes that argument, right? So we have to understand that no one society is a monolith, and people are going to have different perspectives and different points of view, right? I mean, I think we can agree on that.
Well, yes, but when you're talking about atheism, the only problem with that is atheism doesn't have, it's fundamentally different than religions. It doesn't have foundational text.
It doesn't have a scripture, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't have a scripture.
So it's a little different.
Right, but it goes to show that even in the in lacking any scripture, human beings still do horrible and horrific things
on
a mass scale, right? So it's not the scripture that's making people doing bad things. It's the fact that they're people that they're doing bad things.
Well, it could be. I think that it could be either, right? I mean, do you think people never do bad things because of scripture?
Well, but then that's what, so now we're getting to the second part of the question,
okay,
right?
Sure.
So once we've established that people have the innate ability to do bad things, then the question is, does the scripture come to enhance that and make it even worse? Or does it come to channel that and prevent them from doing bad things by explaining what one you know objective sense of morality is, right? That what does the Quran define as morality? And so here, this is where the Quran itself says repeatedly, extensively, that you must investigate, you must study, you must contemplate, you must reflect. I mean, for crying out loud, the very first word of the Quran ever revealed was Iqra, which means to read, to recite, to convey. This is the genesis of the Quran. Was you must read, recite, convey, investigate, and contemplate, reflect. You know, without that basic fundamental principle, any idiot can contrive whatever they want out of the Quran, and some idiots do, like ISIS. You know, a study just came out of Germany just yesterday. I was reading this, and this has been corroborated by the FBI. This has been corroborated by MI6, that radical Muslims consistently have a novice or naive understanding of Islam. It's a consistent factor across the board that extremists will recruit religious novices. And this is not just in Islam, but this is also in white supremacy terrorism. This is also in terrorism done by Christians. If you look at the Central Africa Republic, for example, or if you look at the Lord's Resistance Army, this is a Christian terrorist group in Uganda who will kidnap children at a young age, brainwash them, and then force them to commit atrocities. Because when they're young and naive, they're easy to mold. So, you know, that's a tried and true method across the board. It has nothing to do with Islam. It has nothing to do with atheism. It has everything to do with extremists finding a way to manipulate and to misrepresent what a teaching actually is. But now we get to your fundamental question that, hey, what about all these violent verses in the Quran? How do you reconcile these? Well, the Quran answers that beautifully as well. In chapter 3, verse 8, it says that this Quran has been revealed by God. It is a book that must be read in completion. In every verse must be taken into account. And then the follow-up verse says that there are some verses here that people can manipulate, and those in whose hearts is a disease will find ways to manipulate and bring about violent interpretations. So at the very beginning, you know, it points out very clearly that one, you have to look at all the verses in context, so you can't cherry pick verses. And two, there's no doubt that some people will misrepresent these verses and find violent interpretations thereof. But in that very short argument is a solution to prevent people from taking violent interpretations. And that is, you look at the Quran as a whole. You cannot cherry pick. So these violent verses that you're referring to, what I can guarantee you, and this is something that Graham Wood refuses, and I've talked to him about this. I don't know why he refuses to acknowledge this very basic principle. I mean, he's not an Islamic scholar. He's not a scholar of Islam in any capacity. So it's remarkable to me that he's trying to speak with such authority in the first place. But This is a point that people like Graham Wood and other critics and extremists like ISIS refuse to acknowledge, that every single time the Quran addresses fighting, it is in the context, the very clear context of fighting in self-defense. Once you have been attacked for your faith, you leave your country, you are pursued, and then you are permitted to fight in self-defense. And even then, the Quran says that when you fight in self-defense, you fight to protect churches and synagogues and cloisters and mosques. And it spells them out in that order specifically. So this idea that Islam teaches to spread Islam by force and destroy churches and synagogues is nonsense, because the Quran specifically condemns it. If some imbecile ignores the full context and detailed explanation of when you're allowed to fight and only looks at the verse permitting self-defense, that makes them an extremist. That makes them an evil person. That does not hold the Quran liable for their own stupidity and their own cherry picking.
That's hard for me. Okay, so you, as I said earlier, you are steeped in this. This is what you've done. This is, you know, you will win any sort of debate about apologetics for the Quran. But from an, like, do you not think the Quran is anti-Semitic even? I mean,
it's not. And you don't even need to take my opinion for it. Dr. Philip Jenkins is a Christian scholar. He's one of the foremost scholars of religion in the country. And he's written a book called Laying Down the Sword, where he analyzes these alleged anti-Semitic verses and points out that there's literally nothing anti-Semitic about these at all. He compares it to the New Testament, which he calls anti-Semitic. You know, the New Testament refers to the Jews as the children of Satan and other horrible things. when the Quran refers to people who do evil things, it leaves its most harsh language for Muslims, who are hypocrites. When it refers to Jews doing evil things, it refers to a specific group of Jews at a specific time and place. So it's very nuanced and specific in its approach. But on the contrary, what we find from the example of Prophet Muhammad, and that's the other thing I want to point out as well, that when we talk about the Quran, it's not just a theoretical exercise. Prophet Muhammad was called the walking Quran in that he exemplified everything the Quran taught. And so we got to see firsthand how he implemented certain teachings. And therefore, the Islamic jurisprudence concept is laid out very clearly, that you take the Quran first, then you take the actions of the Prophet, and then you take the words of the Prophet in that order. You can't reverse that order. It has to go in that order, because the Quran has been preserved in its original format, whereas the Sunnah and the Hadith, the second and third levels of jurisprudence, weren't recorded for sometimes up to 200 years afterwards. So what we have here is a situation where, I'll give you a perfectly good example, and I think that this you might find revealing, that when the Prophet entered Medina as a refugee, the Jewish tribes of Medina, along with a few Muslims that lived there, unanimously decided that he would be the head of state. Now he had political power. So what did he do? Did he enforce Islam or tell people to convert to Islam or you're going to die? Did he enforce the Quran? Did he enforce Sharia law? No. He established the Charter of Medina, the Constitution of Medina. This was a secular document that had several dozen provisions that established, among other things, a separation of religion and state, an equality of Jews and Muslims, universal religious freedom, and a military alliance that the state of Medina is one state of Jews and Muslims combined, and that if attacked, Jews and Muslims would fight side by side to defend each other. This does not sound like a person who was dedicated to a military destruction or a theocratic rule. When the very first opportunity he had, he established the world's first secular document that the United States Constitution only caught up to 1,200 years later. So when we talk about this, you know, this is what I said at the very beginning, that we're talking about proven models. We're not talking about empty theories. And what these extremist groups are promoting today are merely empty theories. And rather than meeting us in the field of debate, they just resort to these ridiculous blasphemy laws, these ridiculous apostasy laws. And I'll close this with this one final point that I forgot to make earlier. You know, you mentioned Islamophobia. And I agree with you that this word has been abused and misused and is thrown around ridiculously. It does exist, but I agree that, you know, we need to slow down. Muslims need to slow down a little bit and not just call any criticism of Islam Islamophobia, because the fact of the matter is, criticism of Islam is not Islamophobia. It's necessary. It's good. And I wouldn't be a Muslim today if I was not allowed to criticize Islam.
Where to go? I mean, are you going to, I suppose, give me an alternate version of the Prophet marrying a 9-year-old and having sex slaves and stuff? I mean, is that a misconception in your view?
Not just in my view, but if you look at the history, it's a misrepresentation. Yeah, it's a flat-out distortion, misrepresentation.
Okay. So I suppose the biggest difficulty, though, is if you have the right interpretation and if that's the way it should be and that's the way the prophet was and all that, why are Ahmadis such a minority and why do so many other Muslims not even count you guys as actual Muslims? If you look at the numbers, I mean, it's astonishing. It's somewhere in certain countries, it's like 66% think Ahmadis are not even Muslims, like Pakistan, for example. And it varies, but it's shockingly high. I mean, it's probably the average is somewhere around 30-40%.
Well, reforming humanity takes time. I mean, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, as I mentioned, we are the single largest sect. There's no individual sect or imam who can claim more adherents, more followers. You know, reformation takes time. Let's look at, you know, when Galileo claimed the blasphemy that the earth is not the center of the universe, he was imprisoned and died in prison. And I think it wasn't until like 1980 or something that the Catholic Church finally apologized that, yeah, we maybe made a mistake. So, you know, reformation takes time. And just because the majority believes that the earth is flat, which was true at the time, didn't make it so. The argument that you should be making, which I think you'll agree with me on, is to these extremists who consider us non-Muslim or who persecute us, is to say that if what these guys are preaching is just simply wrong, if it's so ridiculous and foolish and nonsensical, then why do you need to have such a united and violent effort to stop them? Why do you need to work so hard and spend so much money to censor them? And why, according to the World Christian Encyclopedia, an unbiased source, despite all your opposition, they're still the fastest growing sect of Islam on a worldwide scale?
Right. Well, with respect, I think the problem in the assumption, because again, I want to go back and emphasize, I do believe in your values. I believe they're good values.
No, and I
agree.
I get that.
But I think the assumption behind what you're saying is that the best values are going to be, by definition, the right interpretation of Islam. But as an atheist, there's no reason for me to think that. Like the right version, the most objectively Islamic version of Islam could be good or it could be terrible, because it was something from a long time ago. And but like, I don't, you know, because I don't share your religious belief, so I could go either way on that. So when I look at how it's been taken throughout the years, and I look at the fact that, you know, it's not just extremists, by the way, when 66% of Pakistani Muslims say Ahmadis aren't Muslim, I mean, that's 66% is a lot. It would be hard to call them all extremists, right? Like when I look at that as being the mainstream of Islam, it's hard for me to not say, well, I guess that's probably more of an indication of what Islam is.
Right, but I think you're asking two slightly different questions, and they're both valid questions, but I just want to make sure that, because the question I answered is different than the question you're bringing up right now. What you brought up, to my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, was if what you guys have is this right understanding, then why is there so much opposition? Why are all these groups, what do you say about all these groups who call you just non-Muslim or who persecute you, versus who knows what is the right, what is the wrong interpretation? And so the latter question is a much longer discussion. Okay. And my simple answer to that is, I'm going to sound like a broken record. My simple answer to that is the right interpretation is the one that doesn't need force to prove that it's right. And I mean, I think that's a very broad, but
Hypothetically, just to stop you there, I'm trying to use a different example to maybe make it clear what it looks like from my angle, because pretend you take some hypothetical religion, you know, and the foundation is some guy and he wrote a book.
Yeah.
I don't know that the correct version according to that prophet is going to be the one you don't need a sword for. Maybe you do need a sword because the guy was wrong, you know, like, so it's, there's a difference between what objectively is better values, which I believe yours are objectively, and what is tied to the religion. And I think what makes the conversation interesting and difficult is that, because of what you believe, I think by definition, the better values have to be more Islamic. Does that make sense? Like where the disconnect is there. So I don't know how to resolve that other than to say, I hope that more Muslims start agreeing with you.
But that's where the need for why the Quran repeatedly says to investigate and reflect and contemplate. I mean, there's no such concept as a blind belief. I mean, this is one of the, I can tell you from my personal experience, one of the, my defining moments in my childhood was when a Christian evangelical tore my beliefs to shreds. I mean, he just ripped me apart inside and out. And when I went to my father to ask him for help to prove this guy wrong, my dad looked at me like I had two heads and said, go figure it out yourself. And when I threatened, well, what if I convert to Christianity? He didn't look up from his newspaper and simply said, all right, if that's where you find your peace, knock yourself out.
So, and I apologize, just to clarify, was you've always been Ahmadi and your parents were too, or?
Yeah, my father was the first one in our family born into this community. Okay. My grandfather was raised agnostic. That came out wrong. He was agnostic. I don't know if he was raised agnostic, but he was agnostic as an adult. And after about 15 years of study, chose to join this community. We were raised in a Muslim environment, certainly an Ahmadi Muslim environment. But upon our adulthood, we were all, or as we neared adulthood, we were all told explicitly, clearly that, you know, we raised you with morals and values, but you need to figure out your own path and you need to affirm your own faith. This is not something that we're going to impose upon you at all. And that's something that is kind of the calling card of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, that our if there's anything that we indoctrinate our youth with, it's a simple concept of service to humanity, that your job, your purpose of life is to serve humanity. And along with that, we encourage interfaith dialogue. I mean, I've been to, I don't know how many churches and synagogues and gurdwaras and temples, and it was, again, not by accident. But to go back to, you know, how we know what value is right or wrong, I mean, that's where the investigation and study comes in. You're not going to have this, you know, hallelujah, eureka moment on accident. I mean, it's going to come with years of study and investigation and contemplation, which extremists haven't done. These Google Scholar Islamophobes haven't done. And so that's why they can cherry pick a certain verse or a certain hadith. And I'm not saying you did this, but, that, you know, these people that come after me on Twitter, they'll Google Islam is evil, find the first cherry picked hadith or verse they find and say, you know, eureka, I have evidence. Here we go. And that's dangerous in any spectrum.
Well, okay, I agree, and I totally will grant, and I said at the beginning, like, there's definitely legitimate anti-Muslim bigotry. I don't support that in any way. But I think, is it different when you're looking at, let's say, I got another Pew poll up, for example. When you look at the percentage of Muslims, and this one's by country, but percentage of Muslims who support Sharia law. And for someone like, I don't know, me or whoever you're talking about on the internet to say, look, Muslims support Sharia law, here's this data, is it a little bit disconnected for you to answer, no, they don't, because the Quran says this? Whereas, aren't you kind of saying two different things? I mean, there may be an idealistic or in your view, a correct reading of the Quran that would say a certain thing on it. But from an outsider's perspective, it's like, well, here's the percentages. Like, here's how many Muslims believe this. So, it's not like that's bigoted to say that, right?
So, I mean, let me dismantle that a little bit. Okay. What is Sharia law? I mean, depending on who you ask, you're going to get two very different answers on what Sharia law actually is. Somebody might say, well, for me, Sharia law means that I pray five times a day, that I give charity, and that I fast during the month of Ramadan. I don't think you'd have any problem with somebody who says I support Sharia law when that's what they mean by Sharia law.
Right.
For somebody else, Sharia law might mean, well, I think Sharia says death to apostates. And yes, you would certainly have a problem with that, so would I, and that needs to be understood as well. So part of the issues with these polls is that you take something that's super complex, like Sharia, and try to minimize it down to a yes or no question, and that's just simply not possible or practical. But then the other thing that it does is that it doesn't take into consideration the nuance of 57 Muslim majority countries, which are as different from each other as America is from any of them.
Right.
And the third thing is that it ignores that people simply aren't educated on what Islam is or on what Sharia is, and they're just, you know, following what they've been told their entire life for the sake of just a yes or no question. It's like for me, you know, me asking you, do you support atheists? And you might say yes, but am I talking about Stalin and Mao, or am I talking about the guy who's at the coffee shop who happens to be an atheist who makes the best cup of coffee I've ever had in my entire life? There was a public policy poll done here in the United States, just I think in 2015, and it asked Republicans if they should dismantle the Constitution and make Christianity the national religion based on the Bible. Okay? 57% of Republicans, that's 90 million Americans, said yes, dismantle the Constitution and make Christianity the national religion.
Right.
That's 90 million Americans. In a country where it's Christian majority, you have evangelical Christians, allegedly Christian, running the White House, this kind of a data poll is extremely frightening because these people have the new codes. But you don't just therefore say de facto America is a Christian terrorist state No, you say these individual people who are obviously not very well educated made a very stupid decision in their poll and a very uninformed decision. But to extrapolate from that to therefore demonize all Christianity and Christians, I think it would be a leap. And the same with this Pew survey.
Well, there's you can demonize exactly that group. And I demonize isn't the right way. You don't need to demonize. But I think you can judge that for what it is. You can say, well, those, I mean, Republicans in this country have a problem. And I believe they do have a problem.
Right.
So in the same way, I mean, yeah, it would be wrong for me to say like this whole country or something is better, the whole religion. But when I look at these percentages, I feel like you can make the judgment to that exact precision, essentially, where it's like, yes, in this community, whichever one you're looking at in this country, this like, for example, let's say I'm looking at more numbers here in.
But I mean, okay, I think one more thing that's really important to look at is this. And this is, you know, I gave a TED talk on this as well, that you're talking about some of these countries where blasphemy is a crime.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Where dissent is a crime. So if you ask me, for example, in Pakistan, if you say to me, hey, do you think Ahmadis are Muslim? Right? And I know that saying yes is going to land me in prison. Then yeah, I'm going to say no.
Well, they're not, but it's not being asked by the police or something. It's not being asked by the government.
No, it's not. But from what we know about paranoia and people being spied upon, and you know, like Rimshah Masih, for example, was a Christian girl who was accused of burning the Quran, and she escaped for her life. I testified with her with one of her representatives before the U.S. Commission a couple years ago. The evidence against her didn't exist. I mean, there was literally no evidence. It was simply a guy who made up a random claim a little while later, and therefore it was a mob that was attacked after her. I personally know people who have been killed in Pakistan simply because somebody made up a concocted allegation that had no semblance of reality and stuck a mob after them. So I guess I'm not saying this to make excuses for Pakistan. I've written a whole book condemning the unjust government and the draconian regime. I'm saying this to point out that I think it's unfair to draw this mass conclusion based off of a Pew survey of a yes or no question. I think what we can withdraw from this survey is that oppression of conscience in a country like Pakistan is epidemic, it is destructive, and it must stop. And until we can have a country that's dedicated to universal religious freedom, even these kinds of questions, which may seem innocuous in nature, are going to give you skewed, false, and misleading results. Notwithstanding from the fact that you haven't even defined what Sharia is. And so you're asking people what the color blue is who are all colorblind and have never seen color before.
Well, they have their belief of what Sharia is. They might disagree with you, but they, I mean, they're answering from what they believe. And the other thing I'd ask, the very people that answered the poll, like when an individual person answers and they say, yes, they have a view of Sharia. You might not agree with it.
But it might give me the view of those, you know, 500 people surveyed, not the 190 million people there. I mean, I understand the extrapolation. But even within Pakistan, right, you're talking about, I don't know how many dozens of different cultures and languages being spoken. And I say all this with the caveat that I'm not defending anything Pakistan is doing. Trust me. My family left that country to escape religious persecution. And I don't know if I can go back without being killed. I just want to draw a strict line between what a political regime in 2017 is doing and what Islam actually teaches, and what was established 1400 years ago is what Islam actually
But then
teaches.
Why is it, like, what are the odds that when I look at all these numbers, Southern Eastern Europe, Central Asia, this, I can link it. Homosexuality, I mean, it's in the 90%. The percentage that Muslims say it's wrong. Suicide, sex outside of marriage, it's in the 80s, 90s. Drinking alcohol, abortion. I mean, why do these so highly correlate? I mean, it seems if that's not truly what Islam is about, what are the odds that all of these places have such high in the, and it's not in the 40s or 50s, it's in the 90s of,
well, it's
of
a
these
combination,
beliefs.
It's a combination of two things that I'll submit to. One, it's no doubt failed Muslim leadership. Completely ignorant and completely failed Muslim leadership. You have countries that are being run by people like Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Hosni Mubarak, Dictator Zia-ul-Haq, Assad, the list goes on and on. People who have completely sold out their own people, dictators who have sold out their own communities, have seized power. And then you have that combined with unjust Western interventionism. I'll give you a case in point. The very first time that the Afghanistan school textbooks translated jihad to mean holy war against the infidel was when? It was when the Reagan administration printed books at the textbooks at the University of Nebraska and shipped them over to Afghan youth to radicalize them to fight against communist Russia for us. This is the very first time that they were that these books said that jihad means holy war against the infidel, to kill the infidel, and killing them will get you heaven and martyrs and virgin and all this garbage, right? So now you can simply blame America, which I don't think is smart, because you still have to ask, you know, who allowed those books to come in? And that is where...
Why would that idea be so easy to spread? I mean, if you gave me a book like that, I would say that's absurd. You know, like it's...
Yeah, but not to...
And by the way, no means to apologize for the Reagan administration, but also, I mean, it's... You need more than one party to make that work.
Yeah, but you're talking about a developed... That's what I mean. It's a combination of Western... That's why I said you could blame America, but I think that's unwise.
Okay.
You also need to blame the failed Muslim leadership, right? Then you have a country like Saudi Arabia, for example, who we know is killing apostates, arresting apostates, who is killing blasphemers, who is, in my opinion, most atrociously bombing Yemen, where I think 90,000 children have died of malnutrition and cholera and is being bombed over the last year alone. And guess who is supporting them? Billions of dollars in arms. United States.
Yeah.
And so I mean, so I think we have to look at this from a nuanced perspective that, you know, it's not just as simple as, oh, well, it's in that book, that interpretation is in that book. Therefore, you know, 1.6 billion people believe this radical thing. No, it's, you've got a literacy rate in Pakistan of like 47%. You've got, you know, the death for apostasy and death for blasphemy laws were passed in the early 1980s. And it was passed by dictator Zia-ul Haq, who was funded and supported by the United States. And so you've got that toxic combination there. And now you've got people in their late 20s, early 30s who are raised in an environment that teaches that if somebody commits blasphemy or if somebody apostatizes, then you can kill them. You've got an entire generation raised with this barbaric ideology, and Pakistan is still considered one of the United States' strongest allies. We're giving them $20 billion in aid over the next, I don't know how many years. So if we want to reform this, it's not going to come by finger pointing and saying, well, it's that one religion and that's it, or it's that one person and that's it. We need a better ideology that's based on education, that's based on freedom of conscience, that's based on pluralism. If it was Islam that was radicalizing these people, then you would have seen that in every aspect of the Islamic world, but you don't. You know,
well,
you look at Indonesia.
Sure. I mean, it's a combination, though.
It is a combination.
But a combination doesn't mean 0% Islam. I mean, a combination could mean, I mean, you could say that Islam is a large portion, but you need some sort of catalyst. I mean, it would be hard to evaluate exactly how responsible each thing is.
So what would the counter look like, right? I mean, and the reason why I ask what the counter would look like what would it take for it to prove to you that it's not Islam that's radicalizing people? And I'll give you an example, again, with the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, that we've been around for 128 years in 209 nations, tens of millions of members worldwide. We are being brutally persecuted and arrested and lynched and killed, literally burned to death, shot up, you name it.
Yeah.
We've suffered the most vicious persecution of any community, or as any community. I don't want to compare scars, but as anyone out there. And it has been systemic generational persecution. But despite that, in 130 years, we've never had a single terrorist or extremist.
Yeah, but that's because of your beliefs. I would never ever say that Ahmadis are at risk of terrorism because you have specific good beliefs that put a check and balance on that. And I don't think that other sects necessarily
do. Those beliefs don't exist in a vacuum. Those beliefs are derived from somewhere. Where are they derived from?
From whoever created it 130 years ago, right? It's a particular interpretation that not all Muslims, actually most Muslims, don't agree with, but your community does, and it's a beneficial interpretation, and it's one that.
I'm going to ask you to keep digging. And where did the founder of our community get his interpretation from?
I don't know. I mean, his view of the Quran, I'm sure, and then the Prophet. Exactly. But
from the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. And so that's what I mean. This is not a reformation of Islam. It's a revival of Islam. And so this is what I mean, that we have a 130-year proven model that Islam, unadulterated, leads to peace and pluralism. And that
unadulterated from that perspective, though. I mean, that's why it's so weird, because Islam means different things to you and I because of, you know, or to everybody, essentially, because of what you're talking about. I mean, when you group these vastly different sects under one name that I agree. You cannot label, you know, put every person who believes in this religion in one blanket. That absolutely doesn't work. But I do believe that these polls indicate things, you know.
But let's connect the dots, right? I mean, yeah, it's our interpretation, but then our interpretation is derived from the Quran and the Hadith and the Sunnah 100%. But then the question comes in, you know, you talk about these Muslims who disagree with us. Then the question comes in, those that disagree with us, who has proven us wrong on merit? None have. The only ones that have, quote unquote, proven us wrong.
I can't really answer that question, though. I mean, can you understand from my perspective? I can't really answer that question. Like, I can't really. It's hard to take your word on that. I mean, there's going
to
be
no. You don't need to. That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. You don't need to take my word on it. You can look at the history. In 1974, when we were declared non-Muslim in Pakistan, a representative from all 73 sects of Islam was there, and they were present, and they debated with us for 2 weeks. And at the end of the debate, they refused to release a transcript. They just finally released a transcript. Now, 40 years later, you can read it for yourself and see the arguments for yourself. It's as clear as day. So that's the beauty of it, that everything I'm telling you, everything I've said today,
right,
none of it is theory. None of it is opinion. It's all documented. You can read the facts for yourself and arrive at your own conclusion. And until and unless people are willing to do that, I want to drive this home again and again and again. Until and unless people are willing to do that investigation and research on their own, you can't expect to come at an answer that makes sense, because if you don't know, you simply don't know. And my invitation to people is, don't take my word for it. Don't take anyone's word for it. Do your own independent investigation and study. And if you're not willing to do that, then you can't blame somebody else for something not making sense to you.
Sure, but I don't believe in any of this. Like, so it's, I'm not, there is no right answer. Like, for me, it's still going to be with Christians and with Muslims. And I mean, we can, it sounds like we've said what we're going to say on this. So I'm happy to kind of, I suppose, come to a close.
But
let me finish the sentence. For Muslims and for Christians, the religion is going to be as the religion does for me. I mean, that is going, like, when I look at Christians, when you cited that poll of Republicans, like, that is representative of Republicans. I can make that judgment about Republicans. You could try to cite me like, well, hold on, look at Reagan and look at like these foundational documents of Republicanism and look at these past heroes. And it's like, yeah, sure. But Republicans are what Republicans do. And I look at, you know, Christians and Muslims that same way. And I don't think we can really reconcile that, because we are coming from different epistemologies.
Right. So then, but by your logic then, China, which is the world's largest atheist state, a billion atheists there, it's a world leader in human rights oppression, a world leader in domestic violence, a world leader in religious persecution. By your logic, that's what atheists do.
Well, but there's causality and then there's correlation. You could certainly,
why does that apply to one and not the other, right?
Why would it apply to one and not the other? Because you could also look at, because like there's certain things I would never blame on the religion. Like I wouldn't look at, it wouldn't also be fair to say like, well, people who look a certain way because they're all the same race, like that means it is what it does.
Let's keep it in the realm of belief. We're talking about belief, right? I mean, belief in Christianity, belief in Islam, or no belief and therefore atheist, right? So I think the point that I'm trying to emphasize is that what I've posited as what Islam teaches is not from a supernatural standpoint. These are secular concepts.
I mean, that would be the difficulty, because you're labeling atheism as just another belief, but you can't, because it's just a rejection of the other belief. So it's like the group of other, like you can't assign because there's no causal connection. You know, like they believe in what? They believe in oppressive government. That would be the belief that has the causal connection, not atheism.
But that's the thing, but they don't consider it oppressive. They just think that in our human knowledge, we don't have a higher power to tell us what's moral and what's immoral. We believe that what we're doing is the moral, the ethical, the right thing to do. This is not oppressive. This is just the right and ethical thing to do.
Yeah, so that would be the operative belief. So
right.
Like the belief that form of government is okay is the belief that's causal, not atheism.
But I think you're missing one significant element of it, though, right? And that is that if atheists are what they do, this is what the majority of atheists worldwide do.
Well, no, but I would say, but it's too broad of a thing. I would say that fascists are what fascists, you know, like you could subdivide it to a more descriptive category that makes sense in that context. And that's why I wouldn't support this, like the same, I suppose, calculation for different actions. But when it comes to things that are specifically in a book that, you know, and you can argue the interpretation, that's fine. We could argue about that. But there are things in this book and in historically throughout this religion that would causally make this happen. When I look at those specific beliefs, like, for example, homosexuality is morally wrong, suicide, you know, all the things I just listed, like, that makes more sense because there's a causal link there. Whereas when you're talking about all of atheists is just a rejection of beliefs. That doesn't, they're an atheist and they are a fascist or they're a whatever they are you're talking about, depending on the government you're looking at.
Right. So I think two things to bring up. One, I mean, I think you're holding on tight to atheism as a rejection of belief. I think that's a very basic definition. We agree on that. There's no issues there. And what a believer would say is that by rejecting a higher power, by rejecting a higher sense of accountability, this is what de facto happens and what's happened throughout history of atheist regimes. And so therefore, there's a causal connection between atheism and this kind of oppression. We saw what happened in the Soviet Union. We saw what happened under Mao in China, over 100 and some million people killed under these state atheist regimes. And so therefore, there is that causal connection of rejecting accountability to a higher power and the immorality of humanity coming to fruition. But I think the second thing I'll point out is that it's easy to make a blanket statement that because one Muslim or one group of Muslims does this horrible thing, therefore the Quran must teach it, or therefore this causal teaching from the Quran is the motivation behind it. And the reason why it's wrong is because it's intellectual laziness. And this is why I don't like Graham Wood's work, because he tries to make this connection without providing the actual scholarship or evidence behind it. I mean, his viral article last year or 2 years ago, whenever that was, What ISIS Really Wants, I read that whole thing. He doesn't quote a single Islamic scholar. I mean, not a single one. And I found that not only intellectually dishonest and disingenuous, but it didn't actually...
How are you defining it? Because I thought I remember him quoting scholars.
He quotes Haeckel from Princeton, who I've never seen Haeckel define himself as an Islamic scholar. And then he quotes Anjem Chaudhry, who is in prison now for promoting terrorism. So, you know, if you're trying to promote terrorism, that's a good way to do it, by quoting terrorists. But I would have loved if he had called any imams of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community or
that's a different belief system. I mean, why would you call an Ahmadi Muslim to get insight into what ISIS is thinking? I don't understand.
Right, but his argument, though, is that ISIS is very Islamic. And so to quote ISIS as saying, yeah, we're very Islamic, as your evidence of ISIS being Islamic, that's like me saying the Quran is from God because God says the Quran is from God. It's like, well, of course, it's going to be a self-fulfilling thing. You need to find independent verification or independent logic for that as well. And so, you know, this is why I go back to invest. So if somebody wants to say to me that the Quran says death to gays, show me where it says that. You can't just make this outlandish claim without any evidence and therefore say, well, yeah, it's in the Quran. It's done. And, you know, ISIS did it. They said they got it from the Quran. Therefore, it's in the Quran. When we know for a fact that not only is it not in the Quran, but we also know from repeated studies, independent studies of intelligence agencies.
Let me try to give you an analogy. How would you evaluate this with Christians? Let's talk about American Christians. Now, okay. I'll use some hypotheticals. American Christians overwhelmingly tend to believe that the poor ought to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Now, let's say I have a statistic. I don't know, maybe it's 60% or something like that.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say then that American Christians tend to have this belief? And let's just say it's 90%. Wouldn't it be fair? Let's say if it's 90%, hypothetically, okay, yes, American Christians believe this. Now, I can go back in the Bible and show where Jesus said the exact opposite of it. But that doesn't mean that Christians believe that. Like, if I were to judge the religion of Christianity in America, I still have to go by what they do and believe, because there's all kinds of things in these books. And it's up to the community, like your community does it one way, other communities do it a different way, to pick and choose what they want to listen to more. And I know you can argue about it, but all the American Christians, like, let's say it's 90% who believe that, they would be wrong about what the Bible says, but they would still be Christians. Like, they're still that group, you know?
Two things. One, I mean, obviously I'm not a Christian, so I can't speak for what a Christian would answer for that. But I still think we need to draw a line between what Christians may or may not do, and what Christianity actually teaches, right? There can be two divergent, two very different things. And this is something that the Quran calls out as well. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that the Quran uses its most harsh language for those Muslims who are hypocrites. The Quran calls them the lowest, they use the word asfala safaleen, which translates to the lowest of the low, that they are beneath the lowest scum, just the most disgusting creatures that exist are those Muslims who commit hypocrisy, where they say one thing and they do another. So the Quran actively calls it out. So, I mean, it's so critical, in at least in my eyes, to make this distinction between what a book actually teaches and what human beings may or may not do. Because we know that even in the absence of God, even in the absence of a divine guidance on what morality is, people are capable of doing some pretty horrific and horrible things. A mere verbal statement, okay, now I'm Muslim, doesn't necessarily mean a change in behavior. That takes time. There's a reason why the Quran was revealed, for example, over 23 years. It didn't just happen overnight and said, okay, now this is a moral code, abide by it. There's a reason why it's called a constant journey and a constant constant development. And there's a reason why the Quran repeatedly declares La ikraha fid din, there shall be no compulsion in matters of religion, because the right has been made distinct from the wrong. And so going back to what drives me every morning is this fight for religious freedom. If somebody wants to be an atheist, I will fight for the right to be an atheist. If somebody wants to be a Muslim, I will fight for the right to be a Muslim. Because I believe that only when we have universal religious freedom and people are free to believe or not believe as they wish, or people are free to investigate and research as they wish, only then are we going to have an environment where, for lack of a better term, the best idea will win out. Yeah. And that, I think, is the ultimate test.
I agree with that. But at the same time, when I look around the world and I look at Islam, it does not tend to promote that, except for, you know, Ahmadis, certainly. And I agree with that. But that's the kind of judgment I'm talking about. Like, is it bigoted if I say that, even because by your definition of how you look at the Quran, it says one thing, but I'm looking at all these other examples that don't even, by the way, more Muslims who don't think you're a real Muslim think this. Like, it's, you know, like, that's the weird line that I don't get how to walk.
I don't think it's bigoted. No, I think it's incorrect to say that Saudi Arabia is de facto Islam. I mean, there's as many Muslims in China as there are in Saudi Arabia, right? And again, these things don't happen in a vacuum, right? Saudi Arabia is a political regime that started 150 years ago that is heavily supported by Western power, by Western military. And so you have the U.S. government effectively supporting a regime that oppresses dissent. So if somebody even wanted to present a different point of view, they couldn't, because they have an oppressive regime backed by Western powers preventing them from doing so. So, you know, to suddenly blame that Islam, you know, I don't think it's bigoted, but I definitely think it's incorrect. And I don't think it does anything to advance the actual conversation forward. China is on the UN Security Council, and, you know, they have every bit of power to pass a resolution against Saudi for this stuff. They haven't yet. Mm. Why not? I mean, what's stopping them from doing so? Does that? And again, I mean, not to belabor the point about atheists, but what does that say about atheists, that this is not a priority for them?
But there's no foundational, there's no causality. But we've gone over that. But yeah. I think that also, you're going to get nothing but agreement from me in terms of a lot of foreign policy blunders that lead to support of Saudi Arabia. I agree. I think there's complexities in times where there's not really any totally innocent party to support when you're trying to look.
Right.
You know, so that, I mean, it gets difficult there. So it's hard to say, oh, we've provided billions in this, so therefore we support it. It's like, well, maybe we supported what they're doing over somebody worse. I who knows? But there's a lot, certainly a lot of fault to go around. I wonder, maybe to try to draw to a close here, if there's a final question, like you said, what I said earlier wasn't the way to progress the conversation. What do you think is the way for, and don't answer from an Amity perspective. I mean, what is the way for, if you're looking at, say, Americans in general, like if we're looking at our politics, because, you know, Muslims are not a very large percentage here. What are Christians, I suppose, and atheists and just basically non-Muslims, like what is the way to advance the conversation around this? What is the way to get, I suppose, more people in these places to value the values that we very much agree on, you and I, like secularism, everything, education? What is the way forward in that?
Well, I will answer from an amity perspective, and I'll ask you to keep me honest and tell me if anything I say is not a secular
action. All right, fair enough. Okay.
And that is the head of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, His Holiness the Khalifa of Islam, has been speaking on the world circuit before European Parliament, before U.S. Congress, before British Parliament, House of Lords, you name it. And he's been advocating for three things. One, a stop of the arms trade. He's pointed out repeatedly that this arms trade is the source of upholding dictatorial regimes. Hmm. It's also the source of funding for ISIS as well. Amnesty International came out with a report last year that they estimate at least $1 billion in arms, of U.S. arms, have ended up in ISIS's hands, right, through mismanagement, yeah, and through misapplication. So the first thing he said is that we need to stop the arms trade altogether because it's creating more refugees, it's killing innocent lives, and it's preventing us from allocating those resources to the famines and the starvations that are happening that are easily preventable. Two is he says that we need to uphold justice on an international scale. And what that means is getting rid of things like the UN veto power that is used by, yeah, powerful regimes to prevent criticism or prevent accountability of less powerful regimes. So it's an imbalance in power. It's an injustice completely. And so now you have a regime like North Korea, for example, that's doing something horrific, and we can pass a resolution, but guess what? China can just veto it, and, yeah, we're back to square one.
Same with Syria and Russia. Yeah, it's
Syria and Russia, exactly. So that's
I don't how do you, how can we get rid? You're a lawyer. how is yeah, what is the law on that? Is there any way to get rid of it that can't be vetoed in itself? You know, like,
well, I mean, it's effectively a complete failure of the United Nations, right? I mean, yeah, the interesting thing is United Nations was created primarily to resolve land disputes, and it's failing on that horribly in every stretch of it. So I think you need world leaders to be accountable, and so then that's the third part of it. Is people need to be individually accountable and to elect world leaders who are promoting justice, who are promoting separation of religion and state, and who are promoting a justice-based society. And so to that end, our Khalifa has admonished us and advocated for us to be our brother's keeper, to stop worrying about our rights and to worry more about the rights of others and others who are being oppressed. And that's a lot. That says a lot coming from him when members of his community are being oppressed in dozens of countries, yeah, around the world. He's telling us, worry less about your rights, worry more about the rights of other people. So that's why things like Black Lives Matter are so important to me, gender equity is so important to me, because it allows me to fulfill this obligation. Now, I mean, I ask you to keep me honest. Are any of these religious mandates, right?
Those three things I don't think require any. Yeah, I don't think they require any Ahmadi like perspective necessarily.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Now for us, he's told us to relegate to prayer and to increase our prayer, mm-hmm, and to increase our supplication and our fasting. And for those who believe in God, that's a very good thing, and they should do those things. But whether you believe in God or not, those first three things I think are very practical and real things that if we can manage those things, we will go a long way towards promoting peace and pluralism in our world today.
Oh, excellent. I mean, I think I've kept you a little longer, so I want to let you go, but I think that there's more conversation to be had, certainly. But I take that point. I think that's a very good list you have there. And I want to also say, like, from what I know, I'm not an expert, but from what I've read and heard from you, like, the Ahmadi religion, it seems beautiful, and it seems really, especially in the face of so much persecution, it really does seem like a good thing. And it like, that's why it's such an interesting thing to look at from an atheist perspective. It's like, I would love if everybody just dropped the whole religion thing, but it's never going to happen. I'm not under any illusion that's going to happen. So I would wish that more Muslims would be Ahmadi. So it's kind of a weird position. You know what I mean?
I will say this last thing. This is important to me as well. I don't want to paint this as the Ahmadis are the good Muslims and all other Muslims are bad Muslims. I want to be very clear about that. That there are some extremist clerics who promote hatred and violence against us, and unfortunately some Muslim youth are influenced by them. But I can tell you, my inbox is constantly getting hundreds of messages a week from Sunni and Shia Muslims who say, hey man, we believe what you believe, this is beautiful, this is amazing, I'm not an Ahmadi, but I love the way you're presenting Islam. And so what I would submit is that another reason why this religious freedom is so critical is that people simply saw the arguments we would put forth. If they had the opportunity, they'd be willing to accept it.
They could take it on as mainstream, maybe, and it wouldn't be just
exactly.
I would root for that, too. That's really interesting that you get those letters. I'm glad you do. And it makes sense. I mean, certainly, I think no matter what, I do take your point that people are going to answer these questions you know, a certain way, maybe depending on how oppressive the regime they're under is. But at the same time, that has consequences. It's not as though their answers are, you know, 100% the opposite of what they think or whatever. But yeah, that's good stuff. Fantastic conversation. Really, thank you so much for coming on. This has really been fascinating for me. I appreciate it a great deal. Where do we want to point people to find more of your work, more of your stuff, your book? Talk to me.
You can follow me on Twitter at MuslimIQ. My book, Talk to Me, Changing the Narrative on Race, Religion, and Education is on Amazon. And then check out this education campaign that I'm a part of called the True Islam Education Campaign at trueislam.com. And then meet us for coffee and cake. We will literally buy you coffee and cake.
Ooh, I wish I were near you. I'd take you up on it. I could have done this whole podcast with free coffee and cake. Darn it.
You could have. Well, maybe it'll have to be a part two next time.
Yeah. Excellent conversation. Thank you so much for giving me your time. Really appreciate it.
No doubt, man. Thank you for having me.
Right, really cool conversation. I think that was fascinating. So I want to head a couple things off at the pass. I do want to know, and I did mean it, I had no intention of trying to go toe-to-toe in any sort of Quran-based conversation, because it's frankly, even for an atheist, it's something that I just haven't spent a lot of time on. I mean, my focus has been the Bible, and even that, I'm not terribly interested in apologetics about the Bible. So it's never been my focus, and certainly the Quran has never been a focus of mine. I wanted to try to take a different trajectory on this. So claims that he made about the Quran, I didn't really challenge. I hope that didn't bother you guys too much. But I wanted to kind of get things on the record, but I just really, it wasn't a path that I particularly cared about for the conversation. But I'll say, if anyone has any answers to those, feel free to send them to me, or if you have a guest recommendation, somebody who, especially someone who comes from a Muslim or ex-Muslim background who disagrees, with his interpretation, that would be certainly interesting to me. I'm not really interested in like a Muslim hate site that has a bunch of quotes from the Quran, cause I can pull that up easily, but let it suffice to say, I find it highly doubtful that the Quran is as peaceful as a whole as he makes it out to be. But that wasn't really the important part. The important part was the philosophy of how do we decide what Islam is? Like, is it the book or is it its followers? Really interesting stuff. I think I made some good points there. I think you do need to judge Muslims by how they are and how they act, and same with Christians. I think when you talk about atheists, I think that you could do that, but you would have to evaluate it at the correct level. Just like I would put Ahmadi Muslims in a different category, the same could be said with atheists. If he keeps bringing up Chinese atheists and saying, well, they restrict religion, they do all these bad things, it's like, okay, well, then you're describing a certain atheist with a certain worldview. So it's more descriptive. It's more useful to look at that worldview, just as I wouldn't lump in Ahmadi Muslims with other Muslims in that way. I wouldn't lump in atheists who are fascists or who are, you know, have some restrictive worldviews in with all atheists. And I think there's plenty more problems with that comparison. But he used that as the counterexample to say, well, Muslims aren't just as they do, but I tend to disagree with that. I think when it comes to what percentage of Muslims are using their religion and justifying things like condemning homosexuality, I think it's fair to judge the religion that way. But you can also use both lenses. I mean, you can also say, well, ideally, Islam could be something else if maybe people interpreted it differently. But the important part is which people are in the world right now and what their views are. You know, the important part, just as I wouldn't judge Christianity now by how Christians behaved in the 1200s, you know, the important part is who is there now. Christians have changed. The books haven't changed. The Bible hasn't changed, you know, like for the most part, it's translated slightly differently, but it hasn't. The foundational text is the same. So that's why I view the metric of how are people acting in the real world as the proper way to evaluate these kind of things. But very interesting stuff. I'm looking forward to feedback on this one. Leave some voicemails. Maybe I can talk about them on Thursday. You can always find the phone number in the show notes. And with that said, thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who supports the show over on patreon.com/seriouspod. Very important to continue to do so. And I will see you guys on Thursday.